All right. Wanted to talk about something that I've been thinking about for the last week. A lot of people have been thinking about, which is the invasion of a church in Minneapolis. Normally, I wouldn't take on these kinds of issues, but it is something that relates directly to the church in general. And I think it's a wonderful insight into the world in which we live. Sorry, get too hot for my. I turn my jacket off. That's embarrassing. You guys now know I wear an electric jacket. Yeah.
A lot of thoughts running through my head.
Yeah, that's right. Richard's tamping it down over there. So this event, I think, has illustrations and somewhat implications for the rest of us for a couple of different reasons. The church that is at the center of this is in many ways very similar to our church. It is a Baptist church. It's actually a Reformed in their soteriology and in their theology. Although it's a Southern Baptist church, it's in Minnesota. But the elder-led, believes in plurality of elders and church discipline, many of the same convictions that we have. And, it's committed to expository preaching. Some really good guys who are a part of that church. It was actually a church that was started by Joe Rigney, even though he's not a Baptist anymore. And it was the church where Andy Nicelli attends. So a lot of good folks that are involved with this church, and it was stormed by a mob of protesters. Now that's unfortunately not that mob of protesters is not that uncommon in Minneapolis these days. So that's not so shocking, and we might imagine that it's really far away. It's not something that is in our backyard, and so therefore not our problem. But I think that it represents a mindset that is a daily problem for us. And it's representative, I think, of a mindset that is growing in the environment in which we live. And it wouldn't be completely shocking to me if something like that happened in our backyard, maybe even at our church, that we had some intruder or intruders who do the same kind of thing. But at the very least, it's likely that we have people who surround us who think the same thing as those who invaded the church. And so it would be helpful for us to kind of dissect this a little bit. And people have responded in various ways, everything from the President of the United States to the President of the Southern Baptist Convention, presidents of various seminaries, Christian leaders, talk show hosts, all of them have kind of addressed. Sorry, that doesn't work. All of them have kind of addressed this in one venue or another, and there's a common theme that has run through that. Maybe I could get some involvement from you guys. What have you heard, if you have paid attention to this? What have you heard in discussions about this issue coming from people?
Resentment. General resentment that it manifested itself in a house of worship.
Okay, that's spot on, yeah.
I'm not sure that I knew much about the church, and I don't know that I've ever heard what denomination of
Yeah, resentment, maybe disgust. That's been one of the words I've heard. I've heard people use the word disgraceful. In fact, that was the terminology used by the pastor when he was, trying to confront. I don't know where to put this. When he was trying to confront the intruders. And this, by the way, is not in any way a criticism of the leadership. I think they handled themselves with grace. I'm not sure what I would have done in that moment either. The pastor just stood his ground, told them that they were trying to worship the Lord peacefully. That's what they wanted to do. And that he thought it was a disgrace that they would come in and disrupt that. Now, on a just purely legal front, it's a violation of the law. It's private property. These people felt like they had a First Amendment right to protest, which they do, but they don't have a First Amendment right to protest on private property. So they were violating that. They were asked to leave by those who owned and controlled the property, which was the church itself and its endued leadership, and they didn't. And so there is now a lawsuit that has erupted from this. There's charges, I should say, not a lawsuit. There's criminal charges against these protesters. And the details are shocking when you get into it, because if you look through the legal documents, you realize that it was not an impromptu thing. It was a well-organized and thought-out, premeditated invasion with particular strategies to invoke terror and fear in the minds of the people, intentionality to separate children, parents from their children, children from their parents. It's really, really shocking to read. So you keep coming back to this idea, disgust, outrage, shock, amazement, that someone would do this and that they would do it, of all places, in a sacred space, a house of worship. And it has raised the question in some circles, like, is there any sacred space anymore? Is there any such thing as a sacred space? Again, for me, it's clear cut in terms of the law, whether people consider it sacred or not. It's private. And so you don't just get to march into my living room and protest because you feel like you have a right to protest. That's my private residence, and I have some say in that. Same's true of a church. And, you know, I think the church should, press their legal, I guess you might say, right in that front. But the broader issue, I think, it really gets at the heart of how we respond and how we think about this. These events, I think, reveal something about the church and to some extent challenge us in terms of our readiness. And so in light of that, I wanted to go back and read something that we looked at a few months ago in 1 Peter, a passage that's familiar to many of us, 1 Peter chapter 3, where Peter says in verse 13, "Now who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? But if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you'll be blessed, and have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it's better to suffer for doing good than it is, if that should be God's will, than it is for doing evil." Okay, this is a familiar passage to us, and it speaks directly to this issue. Now, people have actually invoked this a little bit. I've heard it at least one time. They have invoked this in the perhaps inappropriate or misguided way. For some evangelicals, the way that there are lessons we should take from this and the way that we should respond is that we should focus on the force of any retort. That we can't answer fire with fire, and so what we have to do is tone it down. We have to show a lot of restraint because we have to give a gentle answer. I agree, we have to give a gentle answer, very clear in the passage of Scripture. But if, in terms of a strategy, if you think that that is going to tone it down or lower the temperature, you're misreading the situation. These kinds of ways of thinking, let me just say it that way. I won't even say these people, but these ways of thinking, they're not responding the way they are. They're not instigating the way they are because they have they felt like your message is too loud. And so weakening your tone is not necessarily going to change their outlook. But there are a number of evangelicals that view the tug of war within us as simply that, a tug of war within evangelicalism about whether we should be, I guess you might say, mild or loud. You know, is the way that we need to respond to this to match the volume of the people who are coming in? They came shouting into a worship service, and so what we need to do is shout them down in response. And I would say to some extent that's been what you have seen represented across the country, if not physically, then digitally. There has been an attempt to just amplify the message, to get things trending, to take a statement I think that broadly summarizes the response, that this is shameful, this is disgraceful, and amplify it, get in people's face and just say to them again and again and again, this is disgraceful, it's shameful, it's disgraceful. And you say it enough until it finally gets through their thick skull that this is disgraceful. What do you think? I mean, is the problem within evangelicalism that we just haven't said it loud enough? Or we've been too meek in saying that? We need to amplify what we're saying so that we can make sure that people are actually hearing and not ignoring what we're saying anymore. If, yes?
I'm surprised in watching, I don't know, first off, do you think that they were aware that they were being targeted?
The church?
Yeah.
No. Oh, well, not in the moment. I think afterward they realized they were.
I was surprised that there wasn't some type of individual resistance to them. But there was a calmness there that surprised me.
Yeah.
I'm surprised somebody didn't throw a chair at them or something like that.
So how, I always have to remember to repeat the question for the recording. So what Quentin's just saying, he's surprised that there wasn't more of a physical or assertive response. The people were pretty gentle. It has provoked me, and I think we even briefly chatted about it at our elders' retreat, just trying to think through security issues. And there have been a number of people that have focused on that. Does your church have a security team? How do you respond in those kinds of environments? Because in the situation unfolding in Minnesota, you don't know if you're going to be physically assaulted with deadly weapons. People are dying. And so you have an unknown group of people who are angrily charging into your church. You really do need to have a good security team who can head those kinds of people off and protect the innocent within the congregation. We, by the way, I don't know if you guys know, we have a security team. We hire every week an officer who is parked in the parking lot as a pre-defense, a deterrent, you might say, who can, you know, if there's a relatively small incident, can head it off in the parking lot, can call for backup. And then within the walls, we have our red badge team, and those guys are trained specifically for security incidents. We do have lots of people who are carrying on Sunday. We don't know who all they are. We haven't asked. We're not probably going to ask. That's a Georgia thing. But we do know there's lots of people who are armed on Sunday. But that's also dangerous because if you got a lot of people packing and somebody, you know, gets, threatened, then shots can be fired and it can get ugly. So,
Shane, might I speak to that for just a moment?
Richard can, yes.
So we don't have a security team because that implies or could imply different saw, at least on camera. Who knows what happened there? You got to kind of give a little bit of space for the situation itself. The primary function of that team is kind of a awareness, surveillance, and communication, so that there can be a uniform response. These aren't people that are carrying necessarily themselves, and the response would not be, you know, to, you know, pull out the iron and start shooting. But the they are in direct communication with our law enforcement person on site, and they have a communication, they're connected to one another. So it's really about uniform response and awareness, and then communication with law enforcement to respond. You really don't want, like you said, you don't want people taking matters in their own hands unless they have an immediate personal, you know, they're in proximity to a threat. Mm. Otherwise, people would get unnecessarily potentially harmed.
Yeah. That's good. So we'll just call them the Red Badge Team.
That's what we call
them. The Red Badge Team. They're the ones who at least tell us where to go to find safety.
I would like to reinforce the fact that if we sit here on a Tuesday morning and think this isn't in Woodstock, you need to go down to the corner of Main and Arnold Mill on a cold, cold morning and see those people who are dedicated to ugly signs and protest and so forth. They're there. And so out of that, you've got to assume that there are people who are exercising their right, but they're also...
I think that's why I bring it up, because it's not as distant as we might imagine. You know, there are trends that you know, we saw happening across the country 10 years ago that are very much a part of where we are now. But it's the mindset that it has infiltrated all the major institutions, particularly the educational institutions, that I think make it more and more likely that we're going to at least encounter the mindset, if not sometimes the activity. And so we got to be thinking about it. And as I said, if you think about this only in terms of a loss of decorum, then you're not really focused on this. What it represents is a redefinition of morality, where a group of people have rejected authority and believe that disruption is righteousness. They are actually taking great pride in their activities, the very opposite of what many people are saying. You should be disgraced, you should be ashamed. Those comments in some ways reconfirm or re-embolden them. When someone enters into private property like that, when someone targets the separation of families like that, and does it, as we say, without shame, I think it signals a shift, not just in what is considered sacred, but a shift in moralities, what's considered moral. And you need to realize that for these people, this is not shameful at all. You can say it 1,000 times. They do not believe that what they did was either shameful or rude. And you cannot convince them otherwise. They may not think it's illegal, but they don't get to say that. But in terms of just the public discourse, you know, we're engaging with people who actually believe that you are the one who is shameful, that you are the one who acts and speaks shamefully. They're not the ones that are rude, you are. They're not the ones who are unacceptable in their behavior, you are. And so they have concluded, as many people do, that it's okay to be rude to a rude person. That you can respond to rudeness with rudeness. If someone insists over and over and over and over again on being rude, then you just be rude in return. And maybe that's what gets through to them. Now, that's not a mentality just in Minnesota. That's a mentality in Woodstock, Georgia, in Georgia in general. Whether you've faced it or not, you are considered rude. Not because of your tone, by the way. It has nothing to do with whether you raise your voice, lower your voice, or whatever. The people who were in the church in Minnesota, best I can tell, are fairly mild-mannered people, as you said. I mean, the response was pretty mild. The pastor was very calm and collected as he had a camera shoved in his face, camera and microphone. Those are all commendable things. This is, in fact, what Peter asked us to do, to respond with gentleness. But that has nothing to do with how he's perceived by these people, because it's not the tone of his voice that defines for them how he is appropriate or inappropriate. It's the content of what he says. That is what they consider to be rude. Every moral system has taboos, and people are breaking their taboos. Yes, Lucas.
Yeah, I don't watch the news a lot, so I haven't watched this, but I was just reading an article, and weren't they targeting him because of his ICE affiliations? So it wasn't as much a religious thing as like a political thing for people that, because they feel like human rights are being violated by ICE. Mm-hmm. So they targeted him, and they used the church as a platform that was sensational to target a political thing. So I can get what you're saying with tone, but was this a religious thing or like a political thing?
Yes. There are a number of things that the progressive left is believes to be a taboo. One of them is not affirming the legitimacy of everyone's self-identity. One of them, and this has come out, by the way, particularly in interviews with Don Lemon. If you listen to him, you know, he has made this not an issue just about undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants, but now he's made an issue about him being a gay black man. And these kinds of people do not acknowledge and respect him. And there are a number of instances, I think, where you can see the cross-pollination of this self-identity this thought of the ability to autonomously declare your identity intersecting with this idea of immigration. Many of the groups who are mobilized in going after this, they are co-belligerents in what they think is a greater cause. You can see that, by the way, if you just widen out a little bit and think about the transgender ideological movement, they have co-opted or are attempting to co-opt the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was another reminder of that. When so many people were out invoking his name and his legacy, not for the purpose for which he was aiming, which was just simply the equal protection and equal opportunity for people who are minority in terms of their racial or ethnic makeup. But now that's been widened out to include people who identify as transgender or identify with another gender. They too now must be given the same rights, even though they've made a category shift. This is not some trait that you were born with. This is a choice that you make. And so these individual sexual choices are now being wrapped up into the civil rights movement, and they're pretending as if this is exactly the same thing. And so they want to borrow, if you will, the moral foundations of that kind of movement to justify themselves. But they're just leeching onto it because they have no moral argument. They have to stand, or they have to borrow from the moral argument of another movement because they can't really stand on their own arguments. Well, I think the same thing's happening to some extent with the illegal immigration. They are attempting to amalgamate that thing onto other ideologies in order to give it some sort of moral traction when it has no moral traction. It has nothing but the violation of the law and a lot of other bad stuff wrapped up in it. If you just listen to the people who are in charge, they keep saying, they're repeatedly saying, that they're going after people who are here illegally, and particularly those who are known criminals. They have some sort of criminal record. That should not be shocking. I mean, that shouldn't be anything that any law-abiding citizen would object to. I think it was the president that was at the podium the other day with sheet after sheet after sheet of child molesters that they're rounding up. And you think, what kind of world do we live in where people are upset about rounding up child molesters? Well, you're in the kind of world where people have confused the moral compass. They no longer know how to think about a moral compass. As I said, they've shifted the taboos, because the real taboo now is not the violation of the law, and the real taboo is not the infiltration of a church, and the real taboo is no longer confusing sexual identities or engaging in sexual immorality in the form of homosexuality. Those are not the taboos. The real taboos now are actually assuming that you can speak with moral authority into someone's life. That's the real taboo. A real taboo is not affirming someone when they self-identify a certain way. The real taboo is suggesting that there are, in fact, differences in genders and indeed roles assigned because of those differences in genders. Those are unthinkably rude in the mindset of these people. For you to suggest that they cannot autonomously identify the way they want, and for you to then suggest that if they happen to be a female, that they have certain restrictions in any way placed on them, whether it's religious or domestic or anything else, that they are in fact not absolutely equal so that they can participate and do everything that every man can do. And at the same time, if you are unwilling to acknowledge the autonomy of these aliens to come into our country if they feel like they want to be here, regardless of laws, and to just simply affirm them. Forget about the law now. The law's not important. It's the individual. It's all about affirming the individual. And for you not to affirm the individual is incredibly rude and obnoxious. And so rude and obnoxious people must be combated with rudeness and obnoxious behavior. That's the mindset. So for you to stand up, for us to stand up and just shout, that's rude, it's not going to really answer the call for these people. And it isn't a matter of volume. And the debate really shouldn't be whether or not we need to amplify that message, whether or not we need to stand up and publicly shame these people. That is also what you see propounded, particularly in social media, is to sometimes what we call dox, you know, dox people, find out who they are, get their name out there, and if you can actually expose them, they will feel ashamed and they will back away from their behavior. They might lose their job, they might face some consequences, but it's not really going to move the needle in, if you will, in the public arena. It's just going to continue to reinforce the idea that you're rude and that you're obnoxious, and it's going to harden these kinds of people. You have to recognize the battle that you're in. The battle that you're in is not one of public exposure. The battle that you're in is the redefinition of morality. It's the whole redefinition of what is shameful and what I guess you might say that needs to be dealt with. So if you are a Christian and you're standing up to these people and you are saying, well, God says, no, you can't do that. God says you can't identify as a male if you're a female. God says you can't lie with a man if you're another man. God says that you need to obey the laws of the state and respect authority. If you have police officers who are conducting raids, you need to acknowledge that they have rightful authority to do that. All of those things run counter to the worldview of these people. And for you to affirm that is the height of arrogance and rudeness. You are flying in the face of absolute morality there in their minds. And so what evangelicals really need to grasp, I think, in the midst of this is the shift in the sense of authority, where authority has come from, and we need to reestablish a sound footing for authority. This is what some writers have sometimes called expressive individualism, that the self now is the highest authority. The self is the highest authority. No person can tell me what to do. Unfortunately, this is not something that is limited only to the right. Only to the left. It makes its way even into the right. You may not recognize it, but there are people who have landed more or less in the same political camp maybe as you, but they have a different moral foundation than you. They're actually in the same political camp for other purposes, other allegiances, and yet they still believe that what they're fighting for is their self-autonomy, their self-ability. They might be in the political right because they have certain economic tendencies or certain national defense tendencies, things that may overlap with some of your own convictions. But in terms of morality, you know, they fly their don't tread on me flag, but they're not necessarily flying it for the same purpose that you are. They're flying it because this is actually their way of declaring their self-autonomy. And so when it comes to moral authority, you get confused because this person that you're rallying with and talking to, suddenly you find yourself at cross purposes with them over issues of, I guess you might say, culture, or you might say, morality, whether it's sexuality, abortion, marriage issues, those things, and your whole coalition is exposed for the weak seams that it has. What I'm saying is this is a broad cultural issue, and if you're not aware of it, if you're not awake to it, you're going to be unprepared in the moment. You're going to be unprepared to really give the kind of response that Peter's talking about here. And what Peter is saying, he's not emphasizing just the tone. He doesn't want us just to respond with an appropriate tone. But he's saying that there's going to be a shift that takes place sometimes. Most of the time in the history of culture, there's going to be broad agreement about what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. And so there's going to be people who are going to not bother you if you're a follower of what is good. If you're doing good, there's going to be a recognition of that good, and they're going to pretty much leave you alone. Now this falls, I think, this falls into the field of what one writer, a guy named Aaron Renn, R-E-N-N, about 5 years ago, wrote a book where he articulated this three worlds view, a positive, neutral, and negative world. And he said that there was a season in the history maybe of America, but certainly of Western civilization, where being a Christian, being religious for that matter, was a positive thing. We were in a positive world where it was beneficial to be known, to be involved with the church, to be involved with religion, to be a religious person. It got you social benefit. And so people, particularly politicians, they, even if they weren't religious, they made a show of it. They wanted people to know that they were members of XYZ church and that they had this religious experience. We fell into, in recent decades, a neutral world. Some people might debate when it happened, maybe in the 70s, maybe in the 80s, maybe in the 90s. But we fell into this environment where now people really didn't care. It was just a personal matter for you. They weren't impressed. They weren't unimpressed if you were religious or not. It was just a thing between you and God. But Wren says we're now moving into the negative world. The negative world where it is a net negative to be involved with religion, to be involved with the church. Why? Because people look at you as rude. They look at you as shameful. The things that you endorse and stand for, things like traditional marriage, things like traditional morality, things like the rule of law and the affirmation of authorities, a recognition of everything from a president to a local police officer. All of those things are shameful. It's a failure to recognize the fundamental struggle of oppression and oppressed. And so what we have to do is we have to learn to identify with the oppressed people. Those oppressed people are racial minorities, they're sexual minorities, and now in this situation, they are illegal immigrants. These are the oppressed people. They're here because they're oppressed. And they have fled the oppression of their other country, and they're just looking for freedom. And you are incredibly obtuse to not want to grant them their freedom. The freedom to be who they are, the freedom to find a good life. All that kind of moral-sounding language is what you encounter. But what it really is just cloaked self-autonomy. It's just self-autonomy cloaked in religiously or moral-sounding language. And so we've got to understand how to combat that as believers, to recognize that in the form of thinking of particularly the progressive left, now harm is defined socially and even psychologically. You are, in fact, a violent person. By not affirming these people, you're committing acts of violence against them, and so they're justified to commit acts of violence against you. What you're doing is actually threatening them. You're threatening their very existence. So you can disagree. And this is another thing that has come up. What happened? We can't disagree anymore in public discourse. We can't just kind of get together and talk through issues. Everything has to turn violent. Yeah, it has to be turned violent because you taking a moral stand the way that you do is attacking these people and their very existence, their very identity. And so for you to speak clearly about sin or about gender definitions or sexual morality or to insist on these kinds of absolutes is actually perceived as aggressive and harmful and rude, even if you say it in the sweetest tone, even if you say it in the most gentle tone. It is looked at as aggressive. And so in that framework, you have to realize that tone cannot overrule content. Every disagreement, no matter how polite you are, is going to be looked at as inappropriate. You are inappropriate by the very things that you affirm and the very things that you believe. And so these progressives, they don't look at themselves as rude. They don't look at themselves as disgraceful. You can shout it at the rooftops all you want. The message isn't going to get through if you're saying that. Why? Because you have different moral foundations. Or you might say it this way. Your moral center is different. Your moral center is God. Their moral center is themselves. And that plays itself out in different strata of society. You can have a conversation at the water cooler at work And you might very well be talking to someone who still culturally in Georgia would never storm a church, but they still consider you incredibly inappropriate, no matter what your tone is, no matter how loud you say it. Say it gently, softly. You can tell them, oh, I love people. You can tell them, you know, how compassionate you are. But then you start saying that, no, a man is a man, a woman is a woman, and we ought to obey the law. You are incredibly inappropriate and offensive. And it will eventually evoke from that person some response to your offensiveness. It might just be they avoid you. It might be that they try to undermine you and report you to HR. It might be that they get you fired. It might be that they key your car. It might be something, but you are so offensive, not because of your tone. You could be the gentlest, sweetest person. All of you guys are. I know you. But that's not the way you're going to be seen. And so this is not a debate about decorum. If you want to have the debate about decorum, you're missing the mark. This is not about that. This is about morality. How is morality established? Who has the right to establish morality? And that's where we have to reclaim the message that is core to us, which is the fact that Christ is coming. He is coming as he came the first time, and he is judge. He's the judge of all mankind. And that his first coming and his resurrection were in many ways the evidence of that. They were evidence of the fact that he conquered death and that he reigns over life and that he has all the authority in the world to make all of these judgments. Now, you say that and you're moving into a category that many of the progressives are not prepared to engage in. They might just say, well, I don't believe that, but they're not really prepared to engage in the kind of if you want to call it foundationalism, because we're really talking about foundational or sometimes metaphysical truths. They're not prepared for that. They want to just debate individual points of morality, but you've shifted the whole conversation. You've shifted the conversation to their accountability, which, by the way, they don't want to hear. Nobody in the progressive left, or I would say the progressive right, wants to hear that they're accountable. Nick Fuentes does not want to hear that he's accountable to anybody. Don Lemon doesn't want to hear that he's accountable to anyone. These are people that feel like they can go out there and just declare based off of their own instinct, their own emotional makeup, their own self-identity, self-protection, or whatever, and they'll just shout it. They'll shout everybody down. But you and I have got to clarify, in this environment, we've got to clarify our message. And if we have any hope of being heard, we've got to clarify our message. Now, to Peter's point, you still say it kindly. I mean, you're operating by a morality. And so you still must act with proper decorum, and you need to act with appropriate tone. Those things are a factor. You don't want your aggressive or rude tone to undermine the very message that you're trying to speak. So this is not just a shift in messaging. It is an affirmation of everything that Peter says here. But we're ready, he says. We need to be ready. Ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within us. And we do that how? How does Peter say it in verse 15? What's the manner in which you prepare yourself? You honor Christ as Lord, or some versions say you set him apart as Lord. Some people say you set apart as holy. I think that the idea there of holiness is the idea of separation. Like you separate Christ from everything else. Separate Christ from the person in front of you. Like that Christ is not, he's not I guess you might say he's not having to do battle with that person. That person might be fighting against him, but Christ himself is not threatened by that person. You have to separate him out from your own sort of devices. You have to separate him out from the legal structure, the governmental agencies, all that stuff. He's over all of them. He's so far separated above all of them. So you honor Christ the Lord in his exalted role above all of those things as you give your answer to these people. You're pointing them back to the majestic and authoritative and absolutely righteous Christ. And that's what you're giving. So again, I appreciate, this is not an attempt to criticize anybody from City's Church or anybody who's done that. And, you know, a few times I've seen the leadership of that. I didn't actually read their letter, unfortunately, but I saw some interviews from those guys, and they're saying Christ is the answer, Christ is the hope, we're here just to preach Christ. They're trying to steer clear of the unnecessary political entanglements of this. That's fine and commendable, but I still believe that the moment requires more from us. Yes, it is Christ, but we need to articulate more clearly why it's Christ, so that it doesn't come across as something that is just for us. That's great for you. I'm glad you have Christ. I'm thankful that he is something of a comfort for you. Now, our message has to be, he's a judge. We are proclaiming this message because it isn't just for us. It's for the whole world. And he's coming again, and we're all going to stand before him. You will answer not to me and not even to the governing authorities. You'll answer to him. So if you invade my church, I'm the least of your concern. My security team or my red badge team, they're the least of your concern. The concern that you need to have is that you have offended a holy God by coming in and disrupting the worship of God's people. And that should strike fear in your heart. And I need to pray for you and help you to know how to ask mercy of the Lord. I don't know if you listened to the disruptive interview from Don Lemon, but he was actually invoking, did you guys notice? He was invoking Christianity. His form of Christianity, he says, affirms these oppressed foreigners. And isn't it shameful that you as a church are not affirming these people? He has redefined morality, but given it a Christian cloak. And so people are going to do that. But we've got to continue to go back to the scripture and tell them that this Christ that you think that is affirming your behavior is actually going to be your judge. And he's going to judge you according to his law, according to his word. So prepare yourself. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Remember that he's sovereign over all these things. You're not actually called to win that argument. You're just called to present that argument and present it clearly. And then let that work on the consciences and ultimately on the eternal outcomes of all these people that we're preaching to.